Welcome to Answers from the Attic, the podcast where we explore the unasked questions about today's headlines to empower you for the future. I'm your host, Agni Sharma. Let's take a look through the attic. A huge point of contention during the coronavirus outbreak has been the spread of information. As we see global mitigation measures start to become more severe, why are we still unable to fully believe everything that we hear? We'll discuss how notions of post-truth and science denial play a part in this, and we'll be joined by a guest after the break. Good morning, everyone. Now, as we ponder how to go about our daily lives while we're faced with the brunt of a raging pandemic, we haven't actually realized how our approach to this global crisis has been influenced by another pandemic, one that's far more insidious and long-lasting. Let's call it post-truth. This term came to light during the Trump 2016 presidential campaign and went on to be deemed the Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year for that period. So what is it? It's roughly defined as the circumstances in which objectivity and facts are less influential in shaping our opinion than appeals to our emotion and beliefs. In today's digital age, empirical evidence is often refuted by our social frameworks. The yardstick for fact has changed. Something can be considered true if it simply feels true to us. And this feeling is often tied to the messenger. Who delivers our information and how many of our friends agree with them is a significant factor in our acceptance of the information itself. This tendency has, in fact, preceded the Trump campaign and the term I just introduced, post-truth itself. It's in fact a larger phenomenon that we've come to know as science denial. It's been an infamous tactic in the political realm to push agendas, one we've seen especially in climate change discussions. Now, the understanding that scientific processes can be erroneous has been exploited. It's resulted in our exposure to the idea that there can be an expert advocating and validating any opinion. The frequent display of this at the legislative and regulatory level, a global stage, has had a trickle-down effect, impacting our mental disposition. And this is evidenced in our approach to the coronavirus pandemic. Throughout this reporting cycle, we haven't been able to escape a sense of misestimating the problem. Politicians are lambasted for a too little, too late approach, or media, in some cases, for fear-mongering and overstating reports. But let's quickly shift our focus to us and how we play a role in this. It's hard to get through a conversation around COVID without someone pondering the validity of the information presented to us. We continue to take aim at the messenger, the media, the politicos, without addressing the complete picture. That there do exist pockets of people to voice various perspectives, pockets with sufficient numbers among them to proclaim some credibility. That in itself is a reflection of a larger behavioral trend. We tend to react to information differently because of our biases. We're biased toward existing views and hence biased toward the information sources or the people that reaffirm these views. This largely comes down to our trust of the producers and distributors of information, as mentioned, these politicians, the media. But as we blame these entities continuously, we also simultaneously consume. We don't share this blame across everyone in politics or journalism, but tend to place the burden of proof more on those that we have some opposition to. We play to our biases. Our belief that this approach to others is acceptable has been largely influenced by the viewership of this very behavior at a political level. However, continuing to practice this mindset contributes to a vicious cycle. Although we commit these actions privately, they reinforce the same behavior at a public scale, as we're able to access and influence millions of perspectives with one click. This power gives us the ability to be put in the spotlight, to become producers and spreaders of information ourselves. If we amass enough of a following, we can determine which causes to lobby for and decide what in fact is deemed credible. This degree of influence blurs the lines between what is objective truth and what is in fact relative. We're increasingly adamant in defending our existing perspectives rather than being open to alternate views, even if these views are backed by scientific experts, all because the perception of the accuracy of these expert statements is now tied to the partisan political media environment. It's tied to our set of subjective beliefs that are reinforced by enough people to push our credibility. And that spills over into the theme for information sharing during this virus pandemic, which seems to be an inability to accept any information without a grain of salt, and in a lot of cases, the whole shaker. But that brings us to the question of what would change this behavior? Is there something big enough? Is this pandemic large enough to curb our post-truth science denial problem? Of late, there seem to be fewer ways to skew the information as the global death toll rises. Further, all of us at the citizen level are starting to realize the need for cohesive action, a collective impact to restore our individual functions. As we begin to fact-check more and understand the magnitude of the slew of fake news circulating, this similarity in individual actions form a collective wave that is marginally addressing the information accuracy problem. We're even being empowered in some cases by the platforms where such information spreads. Twitter, for one, is doing their part to ensure that only objective information remains in circulation. Just last month, they took down tweets from Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, which falsely touted that hydroxychloroquine, a drug used for malaria but largely untested and unapproved for COVID-19, was the magic cure for the pandemic and hence the economy. He further stated that its use was sufficient validation to reopen the Brazilian economy and ease social distancing measures. The removal of these tweets was an important step to ensure transparency and a signal that the top-down structure of information control is starting to change. This, however, hasn't miraculously rebuilt the trust in available information. At the end of March, a former Fox News commentator sparked a conspiracy theory with a tweet that showed a video of a quiet scene outside a Brooklyn hospital. The tweet posited that the pandemic was overblown and falsely reported by the media, leading to the trending hashtag #FilmYourHospital, a hashtag which called for people to find their own evidence of the severity of the pandemic. The tweet was viewed well over a million times and spawned more hashtags, which began to take a familiar partisan outlook. Hashtags such as #DemPanic implied that the pandemic was being leveraged by Democrats and liberals, stating grounds to disbelieve official reports. A video of the same hospital released the next day and verified by the hospital itself depicted a sad scene of bodies being loaded onto a truck, a video that has hence quelled some of the tweet-sparked outrage. But what we see here is that even with a clear, imminent existential threat, we fall back into the bubbles we've built. We protect these bubbles without realizing by engaging in our simple daily routine, checking the news apps that we have chosen to curate the news that we like. We dive into our social media feeds to interact with people who post content that agrees with our views. Now, while we are strongly tethered to our subjective beliefs, the rigidity of this mindset is continuing to be tested by the gravity of the pandemic. We see people on both sides of the aisle gradually coming together, in turn forcing the media to do the same, all while us as individuals are starting to show a similar trend. Let's chat with our guest after the break to attempt to better understand post-truth and science denial to see how we can best leverage our approach to the future. By the time we come out of this, could we be on our way to curing two pandemics? Join us after the break. Welcome back, everybody. I'm humbled to introduce Lee McIntyre, a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University, as well as the author of The Scientific Attitude, Post-Truth, amongst other titles. Now, Lee, thank you so much for joining us. You've spent a lot of time working around the subject matter at hand, specifically looking at topics of post-truth and science denial. Could you give us some insight and help build our perspective on why these are such a problem and how they relate to each other?
Okay. I think that there's a relationship between science denial and post-truth. Science denial has probably been around as long as science, but modern science denial really started in the 1950s when the cigarette companies were concerned over a scientific study that was going to show a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And what they did was they got a room in a hotel, brought in a public relations expert who advised them to stop fighting about whose cigarettes were healthier and start fighting the science. And that's what they did. They started to take out full-page magazine ads. They started a precursor to the American Tobacco Institute and really started to create one of the first American disinformation campaigns. And that created a blueprint for other forms of science denial, climate change denial, acid rain, all sorts of other things years later. And it's now unfortunately become the blueprint for post-truth, because it means that if we can lie about the link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer, if we can lie about climate change, maybe we can also lie about how many people were at Trump's inauguration. We can lie about whether he did or did not have a slow start to the coronavirus pandemic, etc. So I really see a link between these. Post-truth undermines the foundations for democracy because it creates disinformation.
As a quick follow-up to that question, you did mention this notion of lying and the spread of disinformation. For that to happen, on the flip side, there needs to be enough people who believe those lies, who accept that information. So to what extent do you see post-truth and science denial being a sort of utilitarian principle based surely on numbers?
It's interesting. Just this morning, I was reading Leon Festinger's book, When Prophecy Fails. It's from 1955. And in that book, he examines a doomsday cult of people who were convinced that the world was going to end on this particular day. And Festinger and his other researchers joined this cult because they wanted to watch what would happen when the world didn't end, to see how the people handled it. And Festinger was a social psychologist, and his prediction was that they were going to double down on their belief and proselytize even more. And that is exactly what happened. And the point that he makes in the book is that denial is a very powerful thing in the human mind. But if you think about it in the right way, all that's really required to deny reality is enough other people to agree with you. I mean, and I know that sounds funny, but what if you could get everybody in the entire world to agree on something? It's not a stupid question to ask whether that would make it true. Now, if it's a scientific question, does gravity exist? Does the coronavirus exist? Then it doesn't matter if everybody agreed with it, that it didn't exist and it still existed. It would still kill you, it would still have its effect. But there are other truths, there are other things where if everybody agrees that it's true, that sort of makes it true. And so it depends on the sort of truth that you're talking about. A consensus is really important in some facets of epistemology. And so if you think about it, having this built-in group of people who will agree with whatever lie is told in the political arena is a very powerful thing. I think of it this way. Trump's told 16,000 lies now, as tracked by the Washington Post. I forget even how many it is by now. But he seems to have been unaccountable for many years now because so many people have agreed with his lies. It's only now with the coronavirus that this is something that he can't spin. This is something that no matter how many people agree with him, he can't make it go away. And if you watch the news headlines, he's still trying. I mean, he's still trying to make reality conform to his ideology. And that's really what post-truth is about. It's the political subordination of reality. And it sounds crazy, but the ability to get a bunch of other people to agree with you about what reality is can make a big difference.
Now, Lee, you mentioned a kind of political subordination, but we've come to a time where people from both sides of the aisle are starting to agree and come together, do you think the magnitude of this pandemic is severe enough to combat post-truth, to change our perspectives and kind of approach around science denial? Or do you think these two concepts have already seeped in too deep and they're almost too big to change?
It's a great question. It's a great question, and I wish I knew the answer, because every single time I think, oh, this is too much, this has got to be the end, it doesn't prove to be. Years ago, when I'm giving talks on post-truth, at the end we have a Q&A, and sometimes I get a very hard question, which is, how does this end? What will finally be the ripping point at which people just can't deny the truth anymore? And I've always answered that by saying that I thought that there was going to be some event that was so big, that was so global in its effect, that it couldn't be spun, it couldn't be denied, in which people would, have to admit the truth. And at the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, I thought this was it. Because if you think about it, this is a pandemic. It's, hurting everybody, no matter what their politics are. Although there's been some geographic difference in terms of the city versus a country, it's soon going to be everywhere if it's not already. And so I sort of thought that this was going to be the point. I watched the news this morning and I discovered that it's not. There are protests in various cities. The approval ratings are not really changing, and I'm flummoxed by this, because again, to go back to the question about the Festinger book about the doomsday cult. I mean, what is the point at which people say, this is too much, I absolutely have to change my mind? The group that Festinger wrote about were a group of people who thought that the world was going to end on this particular day. They sold everything that they had, moved up to the top of a mountain where they were going to wait for a spaceship to come and rescue them before the Earth was destroyed. The hour came, the Earth was not destroyed. So the cognitive dissonance was enormous, and you would think, what's going to happen to these people? Well, you would think there's a hard correction from reality. You know what happened? They got a message through their leader that the faith of this little group was so strong that it had saved humanity. That was how they reconciled it in their mind. People will always find a way, people will always find a way to believe what they want to believe, no matter what reality shows. And it's difficult. There's been some empirical work which shows that we do reach a tipping point. We will eventually change our mind. But the really fascinating thing to me is that that's almost never because of evidence. It's almost always because of a personal relationship, almost always because the person changes their identity on the basis of a friendship or a family member who helps them to change their mind. It's almost never about the correction from reality. It's some person that they respect intervening.
We see this idea of adapting our personality, our identity based on interpersonal relationships play out in the social media sphere, which in itself catalyzes the spread of information since we are able to create and export content within a click. How does this ability that we're empowered with of rapid transfer impact subjectivity, impact our concept of what is truth and what is post-truth and science denial?
It's an interesting way that you put it, because you're looking at social media as a way to get your individual view out, as if you might change somebody's mind with that view. And that's one way to look at it. But another way to look at it is that you having a voice, you being able to put your views out there, it does influence other people's beliefs. But in the sense that it confirms what they already believed. not that they're listening to you and changing their mind because of what you said, but that because they already believed it, and then they found you and you said the same thing, that reinforces their belief. There's a social aspect to belief, and I'm sure you already know about a confirmation bias, but there's a social aspect to belief such that I think that what social media does is it doesn't just allow us to hear new voices. It allows us to find the people who agree with what we already thought. And that turns out to be a very powerful thing. It's one of the principles in social psychology. And there's been experimental work on this, if somebody is presented with, say, that disconfirming information, something that tells them that their view is wrong, and they're all by themselves in that view, that's a very different story than if they're part of a group where the other people agree with them. There's the social aspect of belief is something that social media has really exploited, I think. It's not to say that you can't get other information out there, because you can. It's just that it seemed to me that social media, the primary thing that it allows people to do is to double down on the thing that they already believe. I can, now there are examples where it can also have a pernicious effect here for somebody who is ready for it, right? Where it can be kind of the accelerant to the fire. Say you've got somebody who's already predisposed to believe in conspiracy theories, and then they're going down the rabbit hole on YouTube and they find a new conspiracy theory. Well, that might be new information to them, but they'll be more prone to believe it because they were already predisposed to believe in conspiracy theories. So yes, that's an example of how new information can cause harm.
On this idea of new information, we do have a sort of uninhibited access to it through social media. There's nothing stopping me from following someone else with different views, but that generally is a tendency that doesn't exist. We tend to stay more towards our own circles. I tend to follow people who are more likely to post things that I like rather than things that might challenge my views. And it's this vicious cycle we put ourselves in, because every day I go and look at the same feed and consume the same type or category of information. And then I go to the news and say, I'm frustrated with the way the news is reporting this to me. How can we, going forward, do our best to break out of this vicious cycle? And perhaps it's have a more open mind, perhaps it's become more open to other perspectives, but is there a way you see us kind of breaking the shackles of what post-truth and science denial has sort of captured within us?
Yeah, in my own work, I think that the most powerful weapon that we have against science denial and against post-truth is individual conversation. It seems to me that people change their mind, people are open to new information, when they're in the process of building a relationship with another person, when they're building trust with that person. So again, there's a social aspect to forming a belief, there's a social aspect to changing a belief, which makes complete sense. And to me, if you read the accounts of people who have changed their mind, people who say used to be anti-vax, but then they changed their mind, people who used to be climate change deniers, but then they changed their mind, they all seem to follow the same pattern. They changed their mind because some person befriended them, took their questions seriously, took their doubts seriously, didn't call them names, didn't judge them, wasn't angry at them, and presented them with evidence. And over time, if anything's going to work, that's what works. It's ironic that here we are in the middle of a pandemic and lockdown, where we can't do that, right? Where maybe the solution to the coronavirus denial is to talk to people face-to-face, but we can't talk face-to-face. We're all at our house, and if we're out, we're wearing masks and standing at a distance. It's deeply ironic that the that what I think is the solution to this is something that we can't engage in now. That's not to say that there aren't other ways, and social media is one of them. But the thing that I like the best about face-to-face conversation is that people are on better behavior. It's not like Twitter. It's not like the comment section of a New York Times article. People, when they're, even if they disagree with one another, when they're speaking face-to-face, they tend to have a little bit more respect for the other person's point of view, and I think that goes a long way.
Lee McIntyre, thank you so much for your insight and joining us on the show. We look forward to having you later on. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
To everyone who tuned in today, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time. Answers from the Attic is a privately run podcast. The theme music created by Kevin McLeod and purchased from the Incompetech website. Sound effects from zapsplash.com. Check the link in description for the website information.